It's really a pleasure to be introducing Rob Malinka today as our Monday afternoon or Monday midday seminar speaker. I've known Rob for a very, very long time. I was actually calculating it over the weekend, and it's been almost 18 years since we first met. And in all that time, I've never been asked or had the opportunity to introduce him. And so it was a new experience to look over his bio sketch and try to come up with a succinct way to summarize his illustrious career. It's really the challenge is to be brief, and I'm going to try to do my best. Rob went to Harvard College, graduated Phi Beta Kappa. He then went out to Stanford, where he earned his MD and his PhD degrees. After that, he went to UCSF, where he did his internship and residency. And at UCSF, he also did a postdoctoral fellowship with Roger Nickel. It was during this time that he began his long partnership with Roger, and where they really did extraordinary work revealing the mechanisms underlying synaptic plasticity in the hippocampus. He worked with Roger as a postdoc, and then later when he was an independent investigator, he and Roger still collaborated quite closely for many years. They revealed many of the molecular mechanisms underlying LTP and also long-term depression, LTD, in the hippocampus. Eventually, Rob was lured back to Stanford, where he was offered an endowed professorship, which he took. He's the Pritzker Professor of Psychiatry at Stanford. It's a position he still holds. And he has continued to make seminal discoveries year after year. It's really extraordinary, both on plasticity in the hippocampus, but also focusing more recently on synaptic plasticity in the midbrain. And it's linked to addiction, which I think is what he's going to talk about today, although, nope, okay. Well, he was debating what he was going to talk about on the stairs on the way down, so maybe he'll be a surprise to all of us. Throughout his career, Rob has been awarded a lot of prizes. He has many awards. I'm not going to list them all, but to give you a flavor, for example, he was a McKnight Scholar. Later, he was a McKnight Investigator. He was a Klingenstein Fellow. In 1993, he won the Society for Neuroscience Young Investigator Award, and since this time has accumulated even more prizes. Also, throughout his career, he's been an extraordinary citizen to the scientific community, giving back to the neuroscience community more than just his research, but also his time. He's served on study sections and many boards. He's been active with the Society for Neuroscience, both on the program committee and more recently on council. I think I'll stop there, and once again, it's a great pleasure to introduce Rob.
Well, thank you, Catherine. It's a pleasure to be here back at NIH, and I can easily think of ways NIH can pay me back for all my service. Are there any program officers here? Just increase my budget by about tenfold, and that would be fine. So as Catherine mentioned, my lab over the last 20 years or so has focused on primarily on the molecular mechanisms and more recently a little bit on the functions of a variety of different forms of plasticity, synaptic plasticity, initially focusing our efforts on the molecular mechanisms of the prototypic forms of plasticity, that is NMDA receptor dependent LTP and LTD, and that's a topic, you know, my lab continues to study. But over the last 8 or 9 years, we've expanded our efforts into studying plasticity, as Catherine mentioned, in midbrain dopamine cells because of the possible role of synaptic plasticity in drug addiction. And today what I want to do is, rather than giving you sort of a broad overview of the work my lab does, as one might do for a big special lecture at the Society for Neuroscience, I thought I'd just pick out one of our recent stories to tell you about and focus in on that. And this is some of our most recent work, which addresses some of the mechanisms and possible functions of a form of plasticity which is found in the dorsal striatum and which we, and I think most people in the field that have studied this, believe are triggered by the postsynaptic generation of so-called endocannabinoids. So as this slide alludes to, it's taken about almost 100 years to elucidate all the different neurotransmitters and neuromodulators that are found in the mammalian brain. A very important finding made about 10 or 15 years ago is that there is a group of endogenous substances known as endogenous cannabinoids. And this gives you a brief history of how those discoveries were made. It was discovered that there was a G-protein coupled receptor, a so-called CB1 receptor, found in the mammalian brain. That immediately raised the possibility there was a receptor for THC, the active ingredient in hashish and marijuana. Perhaps there might be some endogenous cannabinoid-like substance, and that was discovered subsequently a few years later. What got my lab and some of my postdocs interested in this topic was the very compelling demonstration by a number of different labs, most notably Roger Nichols' lab, Wade Regeer's lab, and a few others, that the production of these so-called endogenous cannabinoids can have a profound effect on synaptic transmission. Just to bring everybody sort of to the same page, and I assume this is a review for most of you, as I said, the main cannabinoid receptor found in the mammalian brain is known as a CB1 receptor. There are good drugs with which to try to manipulate this receptor. There are agonists, such as this Wnt compound or THC itself. There's a fairly specific antagonist, and it's reasonably well accepted now that the two major endogenous endocannabinoids produced by mammalian brain cells are these substances called 2-AG and anandamide. The synthesis of these two substances, anandamide and 2-AG, are shown in this diagram. I'm not going to go through this, just to save some time. Most importantly, for the purposes of this talk, the breakdown of these endogenous cannabinoids has been worked out reasonably well, and it's known that this enzyme called FAAH is a key enzyme for the breakdown of endogenously produced anandamide, and this other enzyme known as MGL is primarily responsible for the breakdown of 2-AG. And most importantly, you know, is that there are drugs, in this case URB597, as well, which is a very potent and reasonably specific inhibitor of FAAH. Okay, so this is just a diagram of a sagittal section of a wrap brain showing a rough view of the distribution of these CB1 receptors. You can see that they're very heavily concentrated in the cerebellum, where they have very profound physiological effects on synaptic transmission. They're fairly highly expressed in the hippocampus and the cortex. We were particularly intrigued by the observation that CB1 receptors are highly expressed in the so-called striatum, or caudate and putamen. And what really triggered our interest in this subject was some very important work done by David Lovinger's lab many years ago, showing that a form of plasticity, specifically a form of long-term depression that had been studied for many years at so-called corticostriatal synapses, seemed to involve or require the production of endocannabinoids. And the strongest evidence for that statement is shown in this figure from a paper that David Lovinger's lab published in Nature Neuroscience many years ago, showing that if you give a tetanus to these medium spiny cells in the dorsal striatum, you get a very nice form of LTD, and that this is essentially blocked by an antagonist of the CB1 receptor. So right there, by definition, that said that this form of LTD at corticostriatal synapses requires the activation of these CB1 receptors. So a brief overview of the striatum. As many of you know, the striatum, both the dorsal and ventral striatum, are implicated in a wide variety of adaptive behaviors, as well as playing an important role in the pathophysiology of a variety of very common brain disorders, including things such as Parkinson's disease and Huntington's disease, at least as far as the dorsal striatum goes. In terms of the ventral striatum, as I'm sure most of you know, it's been implicated in playing a very important role in mediating certain reward-based behaviors and, most notably, playing an important role in drug addiction. So there's no doubt that understanding circuit cellular synaptic function as well as synaptic dysfunction in this region of the brain, which, as you can see in this coronal section from a rat brain, makes up you know, about 50% of the rodent brain, but understanding synaptic function and dysfunction in this region is going to have very important implications for both adaptive brain function as well as the pathophysiology of many of these very prominent brain disorders. Now, the work I'm going to tell you about was done primarily by a postdoc in the lab, Anatol Kreitzer, with a little bit of help from an MD PhD student, Sheila Singla. The experimental methods we're going to be using are very standard in my lab and pretty standard in any lab that does slice synaptic physiology. The approach involves making coronal slices from either volunteer rats or mice, and then making whole cell patch clamp recordings using primarily, in most experiments, a cesium-based internal solution, which blocks potassium conductances and provides us with better voltage control over the synaptic currents. We routinely use a GABA-A receptor antagonist, picrotoxin, to block GABA-A receptor-mediated synaptic currents so we can focus in on the excitatory postsynaptic currents and their modulation by a variety of electrical and pharmacological manipulations. Okay, so having grown up studying hippocampal LTP and LTD, you kind of learn the hard way that before you tackle a new phenomenon, you have to go back and touch base with all the previous published findings and find out in your own lab, with your own postdocs and students, what findings you can replicate and what findings you can't. Because obviously one can only work on mechanisms and phenomena that you can study and replicate in your own lab. And I have to say it was very pleasing getting into this study of LTD at cortical striatal synapses in the dorsal striatum that we were able basically to replicate almost all of the published findings, which rarely happens in the hippocampal world, I must admit. So here's the first replication. In this experiment, what Anatol is doing is just giving a high-frequency tetanus at this point in the experiment. And I'm assuming these graphs are familiar to all of you. So what we're doing, that is what Anatol and Sheila are doing, is making a whole cell voltage clamp recording from a medium spiny neuron in the dorsal striatum in one of these coronal striatal slices. They're stimulating locally the afferents making excitatory synapses on the cell from which they're recording. They're stimulating once every 10 seconds, obtaining a relatively stable baseline of synaptic strength or synaptic responses, that is the amplitude of the EPSC. Then at this point in the experiment, they apply 100 hertz 1 second tetanus given 2 to 4 times. What you can see that under control conditions, this causes about a 25% long-lasting depression of the EPSC. That is, LTD was triggered, and that consistent with the original publication from David Lovinger's lab, this was entirely blocked by application of the CB1 receptor antagonist AM251. Interestingly, and again, I just point this out for the aficionados in the audience, unlike many other cell types, where strong postsynaptic depolarization alone is sufficient to generate endocannabinoids that can then diffuse across the synapse and presynaptically affect presynaptic CB1 receptors and inhibit transmitter release, this kind of strong postsynaptic depolarization of medium spiny neurons alone was not sufficient to generate a sufficient amount of endocannabinoids to cause any detectable effect on synaptic transmission. And as I said, this is in stark contrast to what has been seen in hippocampal pyramidal cells as well as Purkinje cells in the cerebellum, in which if you give these sort of strong 1 second or 5 second depolarizing steps, you get a transient production of endocannabinoids that cause a very robust 50 to 80% in inhibition of either inhibitory synaptic transmission or excitatory synaptic transmission, depending on the specific cell one is recording from. The point being is that this very simple experiment tells you that there is something different about these medium spiny neurons in the striatum. So we went on to just, again, look at the literature and try to elucidate some of the basic mechanisms involved in the triggering of this form of LTD. And the way one does that is just one takes various pharmacological agents that block this or that receptor and asks the question of whether that particular drug or manipulation blocks that form of plasticity. And again, this is just a replication of previously published work, much of it from David Lovinger's lab. And what we found, consistent with the literature, is that an antagonist of metabotropic glutamate receptors could block this form of LTD. Most interestingly for us, application of a dopamine D2 receptor antagonist could largely block this form of LTD. And that was of interest because one of my side interests for many, many years has been trying to figure out what it is physiologically that dopamine does in target structures such as the striatum. And again, this is a replication of previously published work. Interestingly, Anatol found that direct activation of group 1 metabotropic glutamate receptors using the agonist DHPG could also elicit an LTD, and that this too was largely blocked by the CB1 receptor, antagonist AM251. So what this says is that activation of the postsynaptic mGluRs directly, while the cell is modestly depolarized, and this will become important in a second, is sufficient to cause these cells to generate enough endocannabinoids to trigger this form of plasticity. Now, why do you have to hold the cell at minus 50 millivolts in response to this application of the group 1 metabotropic glutamate receptor agonist DHPG? And what we found, again consistent with the literature, is that the triggering of this form of plasticity, in this case triggered by application of DHPG, also requires activation of L-type calcium channels. And the strongest evidence for that is that if you put on an L-type calcium channel antagonist, you can block the generation of this endocannabinoid-mediated LTD. In this case, we're blocking it. The LTD was triggered by application of the group 1 mGluR agonist DHPG. You get the same result if you use a tetanus to induce the LTD. That is, the tetanus-induced LTD is blocked by an L-type calcium channel antagonist. And again, this is a replication of previously published work. And this just shows, consistent with the idea that you need some degree of L-type calcium channel activation, this just shows that if you actually hold the cell at a more hyperpolarized potential, where these channels are largely inactivated, and then you apply the same concentration of the group 1 mGluR agonist for the same duration of time, you get much less LTD. And this becomes interesting, the role of these L-type calcium channels, because, as again some of you may know, it is thought that in vivo these medium spiny neurons exist in two different so-called states, the so-called down state where the cells are sitting relatively hyperpolarized, and a so-called up state, which is presumably generated by synchronous activation of excitatory afferents that drives it to a more depolarized level and upon which these cells start firing action potentials. And it's reasonably well established now, especially because of some elegant work done from Bernardo Sabatini's lab, that during this upstate, L-type calcium channels are very robustly activated. So the idea being is that when the cells exist in this upstate, that's an optimal time for inducing this form of plasticity, primarily because L-type calcium channels are being activated on the spines, as well combined with the fact that this upstate is being driven by excitatory afferent activity, and therefore this synaptic release of glutamate is also leading to the activation of mGluRs, metabotropic glutamate receptors. So what I've tried to do in the last 10 minutes is just summarize some of our work and actually the field's work. Again, work from the lab of David Lovinger, work from the lab of Paolo Calabrizzi. And I think it's generally accepted that this something along this model is consistent with most of the data. That is that this form of endocannabinoid-mediated LTD involves synaptically released glutamate activating group 1 mGluR's in the postsynaptic cell. The depolarization is required to activate L-type calcium channels. And in some undefined way, D2 dopamine receptors can modulate the production of endocannabinoids. This combination of events in the postsynaptic cell leads to the generation of an endogenous endocannabinoid, and there's some evidence to suggest that the most important endogenous endocannabinoid in this system is anandamide, although that's not nailed down yet. But this postsynaptic production of the endocannabinoid then is released from the postsynaptic cell, and then there's a pretty compelling set of data that I haven't presented to you that the endocannabinoid is acting on presynaptic CB1 receptors to somehow cause a long-lasting depression of neurotransmitter release. So this form of plasticity is profoundly different than, for example, the NMDA receptor-dependent LTP or LTD that my lab and many other labs have been studying for 15 or 20 years, where that these forms of plasticity, the NMDA receptor-dependent forms in the hippocampus and perhaps in other brain regions, not only are postsynaptically triggered, but most of us believe they're primarily postsynaptically expressed and due to trafficking of AMPA receptors into and out of the synaptic plasma membrane, for example. Okay, so it's a fairly straightforward story so far, but the one thing I haven't told you that make it a little bit more complicated is that even though at a very coarse examination at this kind of microscopic power, the striatum looks like a homogeneous structure made up about over 90% of the cells are these so-called medium spiny neurons. It's pretty well established that these medium spiny neurons can be subdivided into at least two general subpopulations. And these go by the name of direct pathway or striatonigral medium spiny neurons and so-called indirect pathway or striatopallidal medium spiny neurons. And why is this important? So I'm going to spend a few minutes to try to convince you that this distinction actually has functional ramifications. And what I'm doing here is reviewing, again, a large body of results and data generated by a whole population of investigators. None of this is based on my own work. But I think it's reasonably well established now that these two subtypes of medium spiny neurons, direct pathway and indirect pathway neurons, have molecular differences in terms of the subtypes of receptors and neuropeptides that they express, as well as important anatomical differences in terms of their efferent connectivity. So let me take you through this. So let's see, these so-called direct pathway cells primarily express dopamine D1 receptors, also express muscarinic M4 receptors, and certain neuropeptides, in this case dynorphin and substance P. They're called direct pathway cells because they primarily send direct projections from the dorsal striatum to the substantia nigra pars reticulata. Now, what's the functional consequence of that? Remember, these medium spiny neurons are inhibitory. They're primarily GABAergic. So what does that mean for this total circuit? It means when there's a strong excitatory input onto these direct pathway cells, they get excited. That's a strong inhibitory drive on to the inhibitory cells in the substantia nigra pars reticulata. So these inhibitory cells are being inhibited. That causes a disinhibition of their target structure, the motor thalamus, and basically a net, if you will, excitatory effect on this very simple striatothalamic motor circuit. And this kind of very simple kind of plus-minus thinking about this circuit has been very influential in thinking about the functional consequences of the direct pathway versus the indirect pathway circuit, such that, as I said, a very useful, simple-minded hypothesis has been that activity in this direct pathway promotes movement, is really responsible for allowing us to organize our movements. Now, in contrast, indirect pathway medium spiny neurons have both a different molecular phenotype and a different anatomical connectivity. They express D2 dopamine receptors primarily. They don't express M4 muscarinic receptors. They don't express dynorphin or substance P. Instead, they express enkephalin. But of equal importance is that they have a different anatomical connectivity, such that rather than projecting directly to the substantia nigra pars reticulata, they take an indirect route to getting there, such that when motor cortex is activated and makes excitatory synapses onto these indirect pathway cells, these cells are not making synapses on cells in the substantia nigra pars reticulata. Instead, they're making synapses onto inhibitory cells in the external segment of the globus pallidus that ends up in inhibitory cells, resulting in a net excitation of subthalamic neurons that then now send an excitatory projection back into these substantia nigra pars reticulata cells. These are inhibitory, and these cells then project to the motor thalamus, and the net effect is an inhibition of this striatal thalamic motor circuit, so to speak. And so a very simple-minded idea, as I said, is that direct pathway activity or circuits promote, for lack of a better way of saying it, movement, whereas activity in the indirect pathway is somehow inhibitory to the net flow of movement. Now, what happens when you get rid of dopamine, and in this case, for example, in Parkinson's disease? Well, again, one very simple but powerful hypothesis that actually has been used to help investigators in Parkinson's disease understand the clinical consequences of pharmacological manipulations as well as surgical manipulations, as shown in this slide. A variety of both basic work and clinical work has suggested that the dopaminergic input into the dorsal striatum from the substantia nigra pars compacta has a net effect of exciting direct pathway cells and inhibiting indirect pathway cells, such that in a disease state such as Parkinson's disease, in which dopamine is largely depleted, what happens is the net excitatory input effects of dopamine on the so-called direct pathway cells is lost, and the inhibitory effects of dopamine on the indirect pathway cells is lost. And suffice it to say, the net effect of this dopamine depletion in Parkinson's disease is that activity in direct pathway medium spiny cells is decreased, and activity in the indirect pathway medium spiny cells is greatly enhanced. And this kind of thinking has been used to help explain some of the core symptomatology of Parkinson's disease. Because you can imagine if indirect pathway cell activity is greatly enhanced, the net effect is going to be through this indirect pathway circuit is going to be to inhibit motor thalamus and inhibit its connections to motor cortex and basically inhibit movement. Now, again, these are grossly oversimplified ideas, and as my lack of eloquence in describing it, I don't have a very sophisticated understanding of them myself, but I just throw this out as some evidence that has been used in support of this kind of simple-minded thinking. This is work from a French group in which they have dopamine-depleted animals and then done single-unit recording from medium spiny neurons and identified them through primarily electrophysiological techniques, identified them as being part of the so-called direct pathway or indirect pathway. So again, these are single unit recordings from medium spiny neurons. And what you can see here is that consistent with this idea is that following dopamine depletion, the single unit activity of the direct pathway medium spiny cells is profoundly reduced, whereas the single unit activity of the indirect pathway medium spiny cells is dramatically enhanced. At least at this level of analysis, at least this is consistent with the kind of circuit model I just presented to you. Interestingly, please note that the basal level of activity of these two populations of medium-spiny neurons is dramatically different. That is that the direct pathway cells single-unit activity, here it's on average about 0.03 hertz, whereas the indirect pathway medium-spiny neuron single-unit activity is whatever it is, five or six-fold that. And this will become important in a second. Okay, so this was a long-winded background to convince you that it was actually important to try to go in and study the synaptic and electrophysiological properties of these two different populations of medium spiny neurons and determine whether there might actually be some functional differences. We already know there are molecular differences, as I said, in the types of receptors and neuropeptides they express. We know that there are anatomical differences in their connectivity, but how about their physiological properties? And obviously, as a slice physiologist, that's very difficult to do because we're recording, in at least in normal rats and mice, these individual medium spiny neurons look identical anatomically. There's no way of distinguishing without an enormous amount of work whether it is a so-called direct pathway or indirect pathway medium spiny neuron. Excuse me. Well, as some of you know, a major breakthrough for this type of work, not only in the striatum, but many other brain regions, has been the development of these so-called back transgenic mice, back standing for bacterial artificial chromosome. This is an NIH-supported effort known as GenSat, and a group of investigators headed up by Nat Heinz and Mary Beth Hatton at Rockefeller have generated a whole series of these so-called back transgenic mice where GFP is being driven by all of the upstream regulatory elements or so-called promoters of specific receptors, specific enzymes, or specific peptides. For our purposes, what has been most useful is the generation of these two back transgenic mice in which GFP is being driven by either the D2 dopamine receptor upstream regulatory elements or promoter, or the M4 muscarinic receptor. That's important because remember, I said indirect pathway cells express D2 dopamine receptors, whereas direct pathway cells express M4 muscarinic receptors. There actually also is a D1 dopamine receptor GFP back transgenic. At the time we were doing these studies, we just didn't have that available to us. And this is just to convince you that, yes, indeed, in these back transgenic mice, different populations of medium spiny neurons are actually being labeled. And in fact, they do have different anatomical connectivity. I don't have time to really justify that statement. You'll just have to trust me. But work not only from my lab, but also from Jim Surmeyer's lab, has, I think, really convinced us, at least, that the GFP really is labeling these two distinct populations. So what we set out to do is first just to examine the basic physiological properties, just doing some very rudimentary electrophysiological assays. The first thing Anatol did was basically look at the paired, so-called paired pulse ratios of synaptic currents recorded from direct and indirect pathway cells. As most of you know, this is an assay which inversely correlates with the average probability of release of the excitatory synapses on the cell from which we're recording, such that, excuse me, when synapses have a lower probability of release, their paired pulse ratio is larger. And again, paired pulse ratio is just means we are giving two stimuli, afferent stimuli, separated by 25, 50, 100, 150, or 250 milliseconds, and comparing the amplitude of the second response, the second synaptic current, as compared to the first synaptic current. And what you can see here is that the paired pulse ratio was significantly lower in the indirect pathway cells, both when we were recording using slices prepared from the back transgenic mice in which GFP is driven by, is expressed in those cells expressing muscarinic 4 receptors, as well as in the back transgenic mice in which the GFP is being expressed in those cells that normally express D2 dopamine receptors. This was important because the GFP expressing cells are actually in the opposite populations in these two lines of mice. Yet the relative change in the paired pulse ratio was identical. So this gave us some confidence that, yes, indeed, the GFP is labeling two different populations. And for the remainder of our talk, most of the work is going to be done using these D2-back transgenic mice, simply because the GFP fluorescence is very high and robust, and it's very easy to detect whether a cell is expressing GFP or not. So again, the take-home message is that D2 dopamine receptor expressing cells have a lower paired pulse ratio that's consistent with the excitatory synapses on those cells having a higher probability of release. And consistent with that, when Anatol just recorded so-called miniature synaptic currents and measured their amplitude and frequency, he found that the frequency of miniature synaptic currents in these indirect pathway cells, just look at this graph, the mean frequency, was significantly higher. That, too, is consistent with a higher probability of release at these synapses. The amplitude of these miniature events was not different. He also did a very cursory examination of just the basic intrinsic membrane excitability of these two populations of cells, and there was quite a dramatic difference. So in this experiment, he's simply giving depolarizing current pulses while recording in current clamp. So the cell is allowed to depolarize and fire off spikes. And all this shows you is that for a given current injection, these indirect pathway D2 dopamine receptor expressing cells fired off a lot more action potentials, meaning they were more excitable. And I will say that Jim Surmeyer's lab, who has been working in the, I think he gave a talk here a month or so ago, who's been working in the striatum for a lot longer than I have, has done very similar experiments studying the differences in the electrophysiological properties using these same mice, and has essentially, he told me, gotten the exact same results. So that's very pleasing. So these indirect pathway D2 dopamine receptor expressing medium spiny cells appear to, their synapses appear to have a higher probability of release, and they appear to be more excitable. And remember when I showed you this slide, that's actually consistent with just the basal single unit activity of these indirect pathway cells. That is, the indirect pathway cells have a much higher basal spontaneous single unit activity. Okay, so what does this all have to do with LTD? Well, obviously, we were most interested in the possibility that this form of synaptic plasticity, this endocannabinoid-mediated LTD, might actually be different between the synapses on the direct pathway versus the indirect pathway cells. We were intrigued by that possibility because, as I said, we knew from our work and others' work that this form of plasticity was heavily modulated by D2 dopamine receptors. So it was not rocket science to imagine that perhaps this form of plasticity would be much more robust in those cells, medium spiny cells, expressing D2 dopamine receptors. And that is, in fact, at least doing the experiments the way under our protocols, that's in fact what we found. So this just shows giving the same high frequency tetanus when recording from indirect pathway cells expressing D2 dopamine receptors, we now get a very robust LTD. It's almost 50%, whereas on average, in the direct pathway cells that lack D2 dopamine receptors, we don't see this form of plasticity. And I will note, I would ask you to note that the magnitude of the LTD here is not quite, but it's almost twice as much as the LTD we observed in the first slide I showed you, where we were not separating off direct pathway and indirect pathway cells. So now that we have this finding, we had to make sure that the LTD we were studying on these indirect pathway cells did have all the characteristics of standard endocannabinoid-mediated LTD. So we did the obvious pharmacological experiments, and we found that, yes, indeed, it did. So all of these data are now recordings only from the GFP-expressing D2 dopamine receptor-expressing medium spiny neurons in slices prepared from these back transgenic mice. And you can see here's our LTD, and it's blocked by the CB1 antagonist AM251, and it's largely blocked by the D2 dopamine receptor antagonist salt peroxide. So this is just a replication of what I showed you previously, just saying this form of plasticity, at least pharmacologically, has the same properties as standard endocannabinoid LTD. So why in our hands is this form of plasticity restricted to indirect pathway medium spiny neurons? There are two obvious possibilities. One is that the CB1 receptors, presumably the presynaptic CB1 receptors, are only found on the terminals of the excitatory synapses onto the indirect pathway cells, whereas the terminals on the direct pathway medium spiny neurons might not even express CB1 receptors. So one simple way of testing that is obviously just to put on a CB1 receptor agonist and then record from direct and indirect pathway cells and ask, does it have the same synaptic effect in both cell populations? And as you can see from this graph, that is in fact what we found. So application of the CB1 receptor agonist win had the exact same depressing effect on excitatory synaptic responses in both direct pathway and indirect pathway cells. And in fact, it was able to elicit, in quotes, LTD, because when we chase the WIN application with the CB1 receptor antagonist, AM251, it still didn't come back to baseline. So that says the presynaptic machinery required for the triggering of this form of presynaptic LTD is present at excitatory synapses onto both direct pathway and indirect pathway cells. So the other obvious possibility for the difference we observed in the ability to elicit this LTD in the direct pathway and indirect pathway cells was that there was something different about the postsynaptic production of the endocannabinoids. So how could we test that? Well, we could test that by taking advantage, or how could we further test that? And we could test that by taking advantage of the observation I presented to you earlier, that we could generate this form of LTD by application of the group 1 agonist DHPG and presumably directly activate the postsynaptic mGluRs that are required for when this form of LTD is generated by tetanic stimulation. And what we found was consistent with this hypothesis that the postsynaptic production of endocannabinoids is somewhat different in the two populations, in that when we apply the DHPG and record from indirect pathway cells, we get a reasonably robust LTD, whereas in the direct pathway cells, it's either a much lower magnitude or not present. And we can actually, I'm happy to discuss what this little bit of depression might be due. The obvious possibility is that either the direct pathway cells, it's not an absolute thing. They are able to generate some endocannabinoids. Or alternatively, it could be that the endocannabinoids are being generated by the indirect pathway cells primarily, and they're spilling over onto the synapses made onto the direct pathway cells. And then I can't even remember why I'm showing this slide, but I'll go through it anyhow. So this is just to further show that dopamine can, or activation of D2 dopamine receptors can modulate this production of endocannabinoids in this form of LTD. So what Anatol did here is apply a concentration of DHPG for a very short period of time that in and of itself was not capable of generating this form of LTD. That is, presumably was not capable of generating sufficient endocannabinoids to trigger this form of LTD. But if he did the same application of DHPG in the presence of the D2 receptor agonist quinprol, he was now able to get decent LTD. And this is just to point out again the idea that we don't think dopamine and D2 receptor activation on these indirect pathway cells is an absolute requirement for generating these endocannabinoids and the triggering of this form of LTD, but that they play a very important modulatory role. Now, why do I raise that point? Well, it's because we went on to do the next set of obvious experiments, and that is ask the question of what happens to this form of LTD in the absence of dopamine, when we dopamine deplete the animals.
The first way we did this is using a very crude way of dopamine depleting the animals, and that is to treat the animals with reserpine, which also depletes the animals of serotonin and norepinephrine. But you can see that that profoundly blocks this form of LTD. All of these experiments involve using these back transgenic mice, and we're only recording from the indirect pathway GFP-expressing cells in these back transgenic mice. Again, I should mention that this is a replication of previously published work showing that endocannabinoid LTD recorded in rats is largely blocked by dopamine depletion, consistent with this idea that dopamine plays an important role in this form of plasticity. I should mention we also did this experiment using 6-hydroxydopamine treatment, which I'll show you in a second, and got the same result. So that then raised the question of whether we might be able to pharmacologically rescue this form of LTD in these dopamine-depleted animals. And what we reasoned is that perhaps, now it all, it's coming back to me why I presented that other slide. All right. our thinking was the following, that in these dopamine-depleted animals, it's not as if there is no endocannabinoids being released. There's just not enough of them being released to generate this form of plasticity. So we reasoned if there were some endocannabinoids being released, perhaps if we applied drugs that blocked the breakdown of the endogenously released endocannabinoids, perhaps we could pharmacologically rescue this form of LTD in these dopamine-depleted animals. And all of the work I'm going to present to you focuses on using this drug, URB597, which is a presumptive specific inhibitor of this enzyme FAAH, which, as I said, is responsible for the breakdown of anandamide. So the idea is if we put on URB597, block FAAH, anandamide that is produced should be able to hang around longer and do more of its thing. And that is, in fact, what we found. So in this set of slides, in these sets of experiments, we're looking at reserpine-treated mice, and we've actually done more than just apply this FAAH inhibitor, URB597, which, as you can see, does in fact rescue this form of LTD in these reserpine dopamine-depleted animals. We also found that quinprol, the D2 agonist, had a little bit of an effect, allowed us to rescue it a little bit. And also this other drug, which we don't like anymore, called URB754, also could do the same thing. The reason we're not confident about the effects of URB754 is thanks to a very nice suggestion by David Lovinger, we found out that URB754 was originally thought to be a highly specific inhibitor of this other enzyme, MGL, that's responsible for the breakdown of 2-AG. It turns out that the active ingredient in this URB754 preparation is not URB754 itself, but some contaminant that was in the preparation, and presumably that was in the preparation that came about from its synthesis. Did I explain that at all well? So the bottom line is you have to be very careful when using URB754. So as I said, the take-home message is in these dopamine-depleted animals, in these reserpine-treated animals that don't normally show this form of LTD, we could pharmacologically rescue it with this inhibitor of FAAH. We could also do the same thing in the 6-hydroxydopamine-treated animals. 6-hydroxydopamine, as you know, is a more specific pharmacological manipulation for depleting the animal solely of dopamine. And what this shows is, yes, indeed, the LTD is basically absent in slices taken from these 6-hydroxydopamine-treated animals. It can be rescued either with BATH application of the D2 receptor agonist quinprol, as well as application of the FAAH inhibitor URB597. So why am I going through this in such detail? Well, we were able to dopamine-deplete animals, block the LTD, then pharmacologically rescue the LTD. And that immediately raises the questions of, well, who cares? Does unless this pharmacological rescue of LTD might have some behavioral or functional relevance. And the hint that it actually might first came from these sorts of observations, which were that when you knock out the receptors that we know are key for this form of plasticity, either the D2 receptor or in this case the CB1 receptor, that these animals exhibit profound locomotor retardation. They basically exhibit Parkinsonian symptoms, such that the D2 homozygous knockout mouse shows profound catalepsy as well as a profound retardation of locomotor activity. And similarly, the CB1 receptor knockout mouse shows the same thing. So again, this is just trying to build up correlations. It's not causality, but you know, this immediately raised the possibility, well, maybe one of the reasons these animals, one of the many reasons these animals show such profound locomotor retardation is that they're lacking this form of LTD in the production of endocannabinoids in these medium spiny cells. So to set out to test that hypothesis, we basically took the drugs that we knew were effective in rescuing the LTD in slices from these dopamine-depleted animals, and we gave them in vivo. And so let me just take you through those data, and then I'll wrap up the talk. So what this shows is first, both in reserpine-treated animals as well as 6-hydroxydopamine-treated animals, that they show profound so-called catalepsy. Catalepsy is basically freezing behavior. If you put the animal in a certain position, for instance, the test that is standardly used, or at least that we used, is you take these animals and you put their forepaws on a bar, so they're standing up on their hind legs. Normal animals basically will take their paws off that high bar almost instantaneously. That is, they only hang on for a few seconds, whereas animals that are dopamine depleted will hang on for 60 seconds or 30 or 40 or 50 seconds. They're kind of frozen. And what this shows is that if we gave the D2, if we gave either one of these drugs alone, the URB597 alone, the quinpirole alone, and remember, these were the drugs that rescued the endocannabinoid production, presumably, in this form of LTD. They have fairly modest effects, but giving the two drugs together in vivo, basically the animals were almost normal. And perhaps even more dramatically is this behavioral experiment, where we're just looking at basal locomotor activity. So we just take the mice and we put them in one of these activity boxes, which measures horizontal locomotor activity, by the number of beam crossings. It's a very standard assay. And you can see that in both the 6-hydroxydopamine-treated and reserpine-treated animals, these dopamine-depleted animals that are basically Parkinsonian, they barely move around at all over a 10 or 15-minute observation period. If you give the FAAH inhibitor, URB597 alone, not much of an effect, basically no effect. If you give at least this dose of a D2 agonist, basically no effect. If you give the two together, a dramatic effect. And it really is dramatic. You basically shoot up the animals with these drugs, and within 10 or 15 or 20 minutes, whatever it is, they start walking again from being frozen. So we would argue this is at least consistent with the idea that this mGluR and dopamine-driven production of endocannabinoids, primarily, we would argue, from these indirect pathway cells, actually may have a very important functional role in the control of motor behavior, such that when you lose the dopamine innervation into these cells, you lose the normal generation, and this is the hypothesis, the normal generation of endocannabinoids, and the modulation of synaptic transmission onto these indirect pathway cells is no longer normal, and that might be one of the many adaptations in these striatal-related circuits that contribute to Parkinson's disease. So what we would propose is that in addition to all the other standard treatments that people are using, for at least for Parkinson's disease, that this focuses attention that perhaps big pharma and investigators interested in Parkinson's disease and improving the pharmacotherapies for this disease might want to actually focus on some of the drugs that are currently being tested for other indications that influence endocannabinoid biosynthesis. I think I'm going to skip this because I'm about done. That was just some pieces of data presenting evidence that in addition to the production of endocannabinoids and these endocannabinoids activating on presynaptic CB1 receptors and presynaptic terminals, that another requirement for the generation of this form of LTD is that you actually have to have presynaptic activity coincident with the CB1 receptor activation. And that's a mechanism for actually providing some input or synapse specificity for this form of plasticity. So to summarize, what I've tried to convince you of is that this endocannabinoid LTD is primarily restricted to these D2 dopamine receptor indirect pathway medium spiny neurons. I just summarized some data that I didn't show you, that it's synapse specific because it requires presynaptic activity, that it's prevented by dopamine depletion but can be rescued by a D2 agonist and an inhibitor of at least of anandamide degradation, an inhibitor of this enzyme FAAH. And that these pharmacological manipulations that rescued the LTD in dopamine-depleted animals actually had a profound effect on the motor performance of these Parkinsonian animals, suggesting some possible therapeutic benefit. So I will stop there, and I want to again acknowledge that almost all of this work was done by Anatol Kreitzer, a postdoc in my lab, who now has his own lab at the Gladstone Institute at UCSF, with some help from Sheila Singla, an MD-PhD student in the lab. And we're very grateful to Nat Heinz and William Yang of the GenSat project for both generating these mice and then making them available to the greater neuroscientific community. So I'll stop there, and I'm happy to answer any questions. I'm also happy not to answer any questions. I think the question was, there's a very high concentration of CB1 receptors in the cerebellum, and that is true, and there is no question, I don't think, that the production of these endocannabinoids, both from Purkinje cells and perhaps other cell types, greatly modulate cerebellar circuit behavior and synaptic transmission. The question was, might that play any role in the pathophysiology of Parkinson's disease? My quick intuitive answer is probably not, because as far as I know, but correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think there's any major dopaminergic innervation into the cerebellum, is there? I don't think so. And so it would surprise me that sort of the actions of endocannabinoids and their ability to modify cerebellar circuit behavior would be that abnormal following dopamine loss and dopamine depletion, other than in some very complex adaptive way, because once one part of your brain is screwed up, all your other parts of your brain try to start adapting and making up for that.
I was very intrigued by the D1, D2 effects. So, if I understood correctly, when you apply the WEAN drug, you get LTD in both, but when you stimulate, you don't get. But you also said that there was higher probability of release in the indirect pathway neurons. So as a consequence, you're stimulating more those neurons if you use just, extracellular stimulation. Could it be a threshold effect? Have you tried to bring the D1 neurons to the same level of the polarization of the D2 neurons?
Good question. It's a controversial sort of area. I mean, in our hands, we actually have tried to drive the D1, the non-D2 expressing cells, pretty strongly. We've tried, I'm trying to remember all the different things Anatol has done. We've tetanized them in the presence of dopamine agonists. We have strong. I mean, the bottom line is in our hands, we don't think that's the explanation. We don't think it's simply that we're not driving. I mean, that was actually one of the reasons for doing the DHPG experiment, where we're directly activating the mGluRs with the agonist while depolarizing the cells. Again, the idea is trying to provide these direct pathway cells with everything we think they need to generate this form of LTD. And you know, you could see we got a little bit of, in quotes, LTD. And I think the question is whether that's because of the endocannabinoids being generated from those cells or adjacent cells. I should mention, just to be fair, that you know, Jim Surmeyer and David Lovinger have done very similar experiments using these same mice, and they get different results. I mean, they basically are able to generate this form of LTD in the direct pathway D1 expressing cells in a much more robust way than we're able to do. And we're in discussions about why that might be. And it might have to do with the way we're stimulating very locally within the striatum in general. I think David Lovinger's lab and Surmeyer's lab stimulate in the white matter or cortex where they use much higher stimulation strengths and are driving the cells much, for lack of a better word, more strongly, and that's related to what you're saying. It might have to do with the sets of afferents we're stimulating. You know, it's not, a lot of the afferents are coming in from the cortex, but there's a heavy innervation from the thalamus and maybe the thalamus striatal synapse, you know, blah, blah, blah. I like that, blah, blah, blah. But I will say we've tried, and we still think there's a pretty significant difference.
Do you see any morphological change in that medium spiny neuron when you deprive dopamine?
That's a good question. As you may know, that's the exact study that Jim Surmeyer's lab has done, where really remarkable results were. He found following dopamine depletion, there is a profound loss of dendritic spines on, is it the indirect pathway? On the indirect pathway cells, but not on the direct pathway cells.
I'm wondering, we
have not done that sort of study. Okay. We haven't done any anatomy.
I'm wondering if it's still possible to rescue a behavioral test by a cannabinoid in such a case, dramatic morphology change.
You're wondering, is it possible or how is it possible?
I'm wondering if in your case, the morphological change hasn't
begun. Or hasn't happened yet. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I guess I guess the point you're trying to make is it's our results would be very surprising if these profound changes in spine loss, because I think in Jim Surmeyer's paper, it was something like 40 or 50% of spines were lost in the indirect pathway cells following dopamine depletion. I mean, the devil's in the details. I can hand wave. I don't know. I can't remember how long following the dopamine depletion how long it takes for those changes to happen. I think we did our behavior. I'm trying to remember. I think following the reserpine treatment, it was like the next. Reserpine works pretty quickly, I seem to remember. I think it was within a day or two. With the 6-hydroxydopamine, it was a few days. And I don't know when we did our behavioral analysis, whether that was a time point at which Jim observed the big changes in spines or not. But in all honesty, it still wouldn't bother me even if the spines were lost, because there is so much plasticity and ability of these, for any cell and sets of circuits to adapt. So, I can't say anything more than that. Maybe one last question or?
Yeah.
All right.
So when you show in the animal model of Parkinson's disease with the 6-hydroxydopamine, that you have the rescue of some symptom with this kind of molecule, so with the increase of anandamide. But if you don't have the presynaptic neuron anymore, because where it's supposed to be CB1 receptor, how you think it works, this increase of anandamide? I don't know if it's if I understood.
I'm not sure I understood your question.
Because you show like that, if you give this molecule, you increase the amount of anandamide, right?
Yes.
And how it works, because you don't have the presynaptic neuron anymore in this model of Parkinson's, because
yes, we do. I mean, what am I missing here? We're presumably stimulating the cortical. Uh-huh. We don't have dopamine anymore, but we have the cortical afferents, the thalamic afferents.
Okay.
With
synaptic and BCB1. Okay. You don't have any more the dopaminergic neuron, but you have all the others.
We're looking at the excitatory synapses by cortical afferents onto these medium spiny neurons and or thalamic afferents onto. So they're still there.
Yeah. I missed that.
Right. Okay. We'll stop there. Well, thanks, Rob.
All right. Thanks for coming.